Hi, Yat'eh, I should say. My name is Jacqueline Keeler, and I am a writer, a journalist. And as you said, I am Diné and Dakota. I'll try to introduce myself in the Navajo way. My clan is Kia'ani, which is the Towering House clan. It's the original clan of the Navajo people, and I am born for my father's people, the Hanktawan Dakota, the Yankton Sioux people. And so one of the seven council fires of the Great Sioux Nation. So anyway, and as a journalist, I live in Portland, Oregon, and I had the opportunity last year to cover the Bundy takeover of the Malheur Wildlife Refuge, and also I have been covering the Standing Rock, the whole Dakota Access Pipeline encampment there, and interestingly enough, my dad's family used to live on Standing Rock. We're Ihonktawan Yanktons, but we lived in Wakpala for many years, and were adopted by Chief Gall's people, his family, and many of my family were born in Wakpala, and so we have a deep connection to the people of Standing Rock. So. And let's see here. Here is some pictures of, here we go. Okay, I have here pictures of both some of the things that happened at Standing Rock and also of the Malheur Wildlife Refuge sign with an American flag over it. And you see all the media there. And then down below you see more of the police military response to nonviolent, peaceful water protectors at Standing Rock. And nice hair. So with the, one of the things I wanted to really compare was the difference between the perspectives of each group. I call it sovereign citizen versus sovereign nation because this is really what is at stake. For the Bundys, they are part of this movement called the Sovereign Citizen Movement. And for the indigenous nations like Standing Rock, the issue is really around sovereignty, about the right to have a say over what will harm or hurt your people, your territorial integrity. In this situation, it's the water and also sacred sites that are impacted by the pipeline itself. And I have some quotes here from the Bundys, and this is from Ammon Bundy, who is the son of Cliven Bundy, who was the original, Cliven Bundy he's a rancher in Nevada, and in 2014 he had a big standoff with the Bureau of Land Management. He was illegally grazing his cattle on their land for about, I think, almost 20 years, and they were going to try to impound his cattle, and he got a whole bunch of people to come and have an armed resistance against the Bureau of Land Management and point guns at federal agents, and he survived, and he definitely didn't get shot. and then Ammon Bundy is his son, and Ammon Bundy is the one who led the takeover at Malheur, at the Malheur Wildlife Refuge, and he came to support a ranching family in Harney County in southeastern Oregon, who was facing prison time because they had done an illegal burn, they'd burned hundreds of acres of public lands without a permit, and so they were having to go. Originally, they had reduced their sentence, but there's because of the Republican minimum sentencing laws, they had to go back to prison because they had to enforce these Republican laws on them. So he was coming there to protest the imprisonment of these ranchers, and then in the midst of that, he went and just said, "Let's all go take over this wildlife refuge that's nearby." And so they drove over there and began to take it over. This was in early January 2016. And he says, "We are exercising our constitutional rights. We won't leave until these lands have been turned over to their rightful owners. More than 100 ranchers and farmers used to work this land, which was taken illegally by the federal government." Yes. And he says, "This refuge, it has been instructive has been destructive to the people of the county and to the people of the area. So he's talking about the wildlife refuge. And then his father had said previously, I don't recognize the United States government as even existing. So they, that came out kind of weird. So this is a quote from Dave Archambeau, who is the president, the chairman of the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe. And he, this is quote, okay, kind of weird, let me look it up. Just a second, sorry about this. Okay. So here he's saying, for centuries, this government has built infrastructure projects off the backs of indigenous people, off the backs of tribes and our tribe that's part of the Great Sioux Nation. And we have gave a lot to this nation. We've given our Black Hills that have gold. We've given our lands for farming and agriculture. And we have given our river bottoms. The dams have flooded for energy independence, for hydropower. So for years, all of these takings have happened and has been at our expense so that the nation can benefit. This is another example of oil pipelines coming through with crude oil. And if anything happened with this pipeline, who would pay the costs? Who would be the first ones to pay the costs? And again, is our people. And so we are the first occupants of this country, of this nation. And forever, time and time again, we pay the costs for everybody to gain. And so I think that understanding for the first time has been realized by this nation's leaders, and it took a lot of courage for them to take a look at the existing laws and really understand and know that something just isn't right. So I should note that that Obama had actually gone to visit Standing Rock, actually at Cannonball, right adjacent to where the pipeline is supposed to be built. And he'd made a lot of promises in 2000. He'd come in 2014, and Dave's sister, Jody, who I went to Dartmouth with, so I've known her for a long time, and she was working in Obama's White House in his administration. And so he came and he met with the people there, and he promised to view their children as his own children and to respect treaties. And sadly, in all of this, you know, they could not get Obama to respond. All these things were happening with the protests, and they could not get Obama to respond until a young woman, a Malaysian college student in Thailand, asked President Obama about the pipeline. And she had been reading about it on social media, and she and he obviously didn't know a lot about it. So it's sad to say that even Dave Archambeau and his sister just did not have the access, did not have the ear of the president to have their issues addressed, even as, well, Dave Archambeau himself was arrested and strip searched, you know, by the state of North Dakota, by the sheriff's department, and he's a head of state of a nation. It didn't even make the papers, really. I mean, it was very difficult to get media coverage. So I have to say so here we go. So I think his statement is very generous. So sovereign citizen versus sovereign nation. So I think the best way to look at this is that the concerns of a sovereign citizen are personal in nature versus the national concerns of sovereign nations. And I think that what I would like to look at are the colonial roots versus those of a real people. What I often wonder is the U.S. still a colony? I mean, they fought a revolution to split off from their homeland, but technically they don't have a homeland. They're a colony without portfolio, a colony without a homeland. And it's a pretty unusual situation to be in history. I don't know that that's really occurred that often. And while a people, a real people, and I'm going to paraphrase my Uncle Vine Deloria Jr., you know, he talked about how our peoples, what defines us is a moment when we have a spiritual interaction with the holy person, with the holy being. And right there at Standing Rock, when I spoke to some of the councilmen, they were telling me that some people say that is right near where the pipeline is being built is where the white buffalo calf woman appeared to our people. And my Lala used to tell me that before we met the white buffalo calf woman, before she came to us and brought the chinupa, the pipe, to us, and the seven sacred ceremonies, we were not Dakota or Lakota. You know, we were something else. But it wasn't until she came to us that we became who we are today. And so really this area should be a UNESCO World Heritage Site. But this is what makes us a people, is this moment where we have a relationship with a sacred being who teaches us what our relationship is with the world around us in a sacred way. And this is a big difference between the American story, the colonial story, which is one of basically coming here for profit motives. You know, I think that Trump embodies that with the his prosperity gospel, and he's been voted into office because he has, you know, he epitomizes the success that people come to this country for, and it's a very different way of looking at the world. So the U.S. Begins primarily with a financial incentive driven by colonial interests, corporate origin of colonies, and that's another thing is. People are often surprised that the Dakota Access Pipeline has governmental powers like eminent domain. And many of these pipelines do because they're viewed in the national interest. So privately owned pipelines are being given governmental powers. And but actually, you know, if you look at the roots of the colonies, many of them began as corporations themselves. You know, the Massachusetts Bay Corporation, you know, the Hudson Bay Corporation. I mean, they, you know, even a corporation took over India, you know, the East, you know, the India, the British Trading Company, but it's all very the corporate origins of the colonies is very well documented and is really central to the United States. And so it's in some ways very historically correct, the whole connection between corporate power and governmental power. It's been there for a very long time. And also the land speculation interest of the founding fathers. George Washington, of course, studied to be a land surveyor, and he was himself a land speculator. And part of the, what drove the Revolutionary War was the anger over the settlement of the French and Indian War, when the colonies were not allowed to move into tribal lands. And if you see the boundary for the 13 colonies, that boundary is the Iroquois Confederacy and many other powerful tribes, powerful Native nations. And so they really wanted to move into those lands, and were very upset with King George III telling them that they could not. A people's story begins with a transformative contact with a spiritual being like Petashan Win, the white buffalo calf woman, and original instructions like the seven ceremonies. That didn't come out quite right. So if you look at sort of fantasy versus history, sovereign citizen versus sovereign nation, you have an unsupported and invented legal history of sovereign citizens versus actual legal reality of Native nations as sovereign nations the U.S. simply refuses to acknowledge. So with the sovereign citizens, you have the sheriff county as the ultimate authority. This is actually part of their belief system, and you'll see that both of the Bundys appealed to the local sheriff to side with them and expected the sheriff to side with them. And because they believe some sort of version of English common law where the sheriff is actually the ultimate, has more authority within his county than the U.S. president does. It's a really strange legal gobbledygook. And then the use of the Constitution to support claims of federal overreach. And I'll go into that a little more. And then Native Nation treaties are proof of status as sovereign nations. Sovereignty pre-exists and persists U.S. federal treaty making. And so I'd like to say that I think one of the things I think we really need to come to terms with is that the U.S. has spent hundreds of years and policy on making sure that people don't know that Native nations actually still exist. And that what we see happening at in Standing Rock is we're seeing the militarized response, which is actually the military force used to occupy our lands. Those are unceded treaty lands, even the area north of the pipeline, and the tribe has full right to those lands. The only reason they cannot access it is because of the military force of the United States. And so when you see the military reaction going on now, it's just the actual situation the colonial occupation made visible. And it's very important that people understand that that is what it is. And the lack of military response to the Bundys shows that they are not actually, they are actually somehow still in line with the American project. Explain a little bit here. I think since we don't have a lot of time, you could probably look it up yourself, but they have, it's just a total rabbit hole. they have, believe the sheriff is the ultimate authority, and they have all these strange ideas why. So you can look more into that. And then, so let's see here. So this is where the Bundys call upon their sheriffs. This is Clive and Bundy calling upon his sheriff in Nevada. Disarm the federal bureaucrats, Bundy said in an interview with Fox News' Sean Hannity. He had been asked to respond to Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid's assertion the Bundy Ranch standoff is, as it now officially is, was not over. Bundy had already asked his local sheriff to arrest the BLML officials who were rounding up his cattle, but he directed his new message to every county sheriff in the United States. And if you look at the role that the sheriff has played in Standing Rock to really abuse the people and to carry out gross violence against peaceful water protectors, you'll definitely see that the sheriff is not on the side of Native Nations. And really what the huge threat it is when Native Nations assert their authority over lands that the state wishes to claim. So and I'll probably skip the constitutional original. They have all kinds of strange. Well, I'll go a little into this. They believe that, so in court, Ammon Bundy, this was in his court case in Portland, Oregon, argued in Constitution's enclave, the Constitution's enclave clause limits federal authority to own lands of about 640 million acres. Claims clause says U.S. may only own lands it purchases with the consent of states for the purposes of forts, magazines, arsenals, dockyards, and other needful buildings. And one of the strange ideas they have is that states have inherent sovereignty. And most states beyond the 13 colonies never possessed sovereignty that pre-existed the United States. So they receive their self-governing rights from the United States. It's gifted to them. So it's sort of a strange, but you can say, but basically he does not believe that, him and his father do not believe that the U.S. has, the federal government has any authority over them. This is a piece I wrote for The Nation in 2014 about Clive and Bundy's ancestral rights, and I'll just read a little bit of it for you. I wrote, as a Native American, I find Bundy's late 19th century claims of ancestral rights presumptuous, since by law all remaining preemptive rights in Nevada belong not to late arrivals like the Bundy family, but to tribes that have lived in the region for thousands of years. This inability to take seriously the ancestral rights of American Indian nations within the United States is not limited to Bundy and his supporters. In Oregon, farmers in the Klamath River Basin were shocked by a 2002 ruling that found that the Klamath tribe possessed senior water rights and could turn off the water during drought years. Last year, I'll just skip over that. Even as many Americans continue to deny the existence of Native Nations' ancestral rights to land and resources, the libertarian right is eager to co-opt our history to promote their own battles against the federal government. Last year, gun control opponents circulated on Facebook and Twitter the graphic photo of frozen Lakota victims being buried in a mass grave at Wounded Knee, with taglines saying Wounded Knee was among... Anyway, it's this horrible thing. And a meme also made the... So they just tried to appropriate our struggle. And disregard, if you can, the incredible callousness of using such tragedies. My great-great-uncle was a survivor of Wounded Knee. To limit restrictions on sales of automatic weapons and to prevent waiting periods for gun purchases, all of which have been shown to save lives. Instead, I would like to explain the very real difference between these two fights, one for the sovereignty of pre-existing nation states on this continent, and one for what Bundy and his supporters call the sovereign citizen movement, which basically translates to they make up the rules. Native Americans, for one, are more than just an ethnic group or simply just American citizens. Until the 1924 Indian Citizenship Act, most were not citizens of the United States and were still just citizens of our own nations within the borders of the United States. But for many, full citizenship with voting rights did not come about until the Voting Rights Act of 1965. So for most of U.S. history, the only real citizenship Native Americans could claim was to their respective nations. When tribes speak of being nations, they are not being poetic or nostalgic. They are speaking of the real political status our nations hold internationally. There are tribes that issue passports. States have no jurisdiction over our lands. And if you look at a map, a U.S. map, you'll see that tribes, despite having a political status higher than states, because they are sovereign nations, they are drawn out in little outlines like as if they were parks. And I think that definitely the maps need to actually connote the actual legal situation of tribes under international law. And then I also tackled, when Ammon Mundy came to Oregon, I also tackled that. And I'll read a little bit of that actually, just really fast. When Ammon Bundy, son of Cliven Bundy, the Nevada rancher who led an armed standoff against the U.S. Bureau of Land Management in 2014, charged into the Malheur Wildlife Refuge near Burns, Oregon, he said he was going to return the land from an overreaching federal government to its original owners. He was not thinking of the Burns Paiute tribe. And he has since admitted he knows very little about them. When he charged into town proclaiming he was getting ranchers back to ranching, getting the loggers back to logging, getting the miners back to mining, the original owners he was thinking about, without a doubt, they were European Americans like himself. But in fact, it is the Burns Paiute tribe and other northern Paiute tribes who are the original owners and possess the strongest legal claim to the land, particularly to the wildlife refuge, which once was part of the former Malheur Indian Reservation, a 1.78 million acre reservation that was later opened to white settlement after the Paiute and another tribe, the Bannock, facing starvation, rose up against settler depredations. Exactly 173 years ago this month, knee-deep in snow, 500 Paiutes were force-marched, shackled in twos, some 350 miles northward to the Yakima Indian Reservation in Washington State. I imagine Bundy had no idea that his takeover was effectively commemorating this tragedy. So on the Trail of Broken Treaties. So I think that when we talk about treaties, people kind of zone out like, oh, there they go again talking about treaties, broken treaties. And I think that people need to have a clear understanding of what treaties are. I actually did a story covering Pretendian tribes in Pennsylvania. Most of the Delaware Lenape people were driven out of Pennsylvania. What has emerged in their absence are these Pretendian tribes, people pretending to be Lenape, secret Lenapes, and it's really quite hurtful to the actual Delaware Lenape people who have been removed to Oklahoma. And I found that the University of Pennsylvania, the Penn Museum, was actually going around signing treaties with these Pretendian tribes. And first of all, a museum is not a sovereign nation. It can't legally sign treaties. And so there's obviously the Penn Museum does not know what treaties are. Treaties are only entered into between sovereign nations. The U.S. Senate only ratifies treaties with other sovereign nations, thus recognizing nationhood of our nations, although our nations preexisted U.S. treaties. Signing a treaty is an act of sovereignty, and under international law, you cannot treaty away your existence. Anything not specifically mentioned in the treaty are retained rights and remain with the tribe. So anything we don't give away by, that's actually literally mentioned in the treaty, we retain it. So, many Americans think that treaties were signed as an act of extinguishing the existence, the political existence of sovereign nations, when in fact that is not true. Signing a treaty is an act of sovereignty. And many of these treaties, including the treaties signed by the Shoshone and the Paiutes, were simply treaties allowing, and even the Fort Laramie Treaty, the 1851 Fort Laramie Treaty, were all about just allowing, immigrants to pass through our lands on the Oregon Trail, and so they weren't about giving up very much. So here is a map of that shows the unceded treaty land. You see it goes all the way up to Bismarck itself. The 1851 Fort Laramie Treaty, which I think is the treaty that most traditional people view as the most legitimate, like the one that we ratified, It was the boundary goes all the way up to the Heart River, which goes right into downtown Bismarck. And then you see the Cannonball River there, which is the present demarcation for the Standing Rock Reservation right there. And you see the original pipeline route, which was north of Bismarck, about 10 miles north, which Bismarck did not want because they were afraid it would poison their water. And then you see the new route, which goes half a mile north of the community of Cannonball. And so you can see it does cross quite a bit of unceded treaty territory. The treaty also stipulates that we have to the east bank of the Missouri River. The Yanktons, my tribe, are also signees of the Fort Laramie Treaty. And the crossing of the where it crosses, the Army Corps of Engineers claims it as federal land. But I'm working with some folks to try to see if we can challenge that the Great Sioux Nation should be the permitting office for granting the pipeline corridor, and an assertion of our sovereignty that goes beyond consultation. And let me see here. Here's another map showing the same thing. And this is a map that shows the lands of the Otete Chacoan. And you see what the kind of the little islands left behind that we still have, which are the reservations. You have to realize that under treaty, we have rights to much of the land in between these little islands. And you see what's left here with the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation and the adjacent Cheyenne River Sioux Reservation. This is the largest extant piece of land left to the Great Sioux Nation. It's about the size of El Salvador. And I have to stress that these traditional communities while most Native people are expatriates, we are forced by economics, we're economic refugees from our homelands. These communities on our reservations, these communities are where the culture can live, where the language can be passed on. They have an incredible value. Endangering them, endangering the drinking water, making it impossible to live there, is actually committing an act of cultural genocide. Because the cultures will not thrive when everyone is scattered across as a minority amongst minorities in American communities. We have to have these communities. We have to protect them. They are a huge cultural resource. And I'm also half Navajo, and my mom's community of Cameron is surrounded by uranium mines. And my cousin died of cancer because of that. And it was really hard because, you know, my aunt brought her children home so they could learn their culture and their language. And they died. You know, one of them, and he was only 27 years old, and he was an architect. And so I really think we need to protect these communities. Sorry. Anyway, this is some photographs I took at Standing Rock. At this teepee here is in the Yanktewan camp, the Yankton Sioux camp. And it has the seven council fires on it. And when I went to the Yanktewan camp, I asked them, what do you need? And they told me they needed teepee poles because they had a canvas cover, but they didn't have any poles to put it up. So I got teepee poles and brought them back. And I didn't realize that it would have that on it. And it just seemed really like quite a blessing that was on it. And then you see some of the flags. What is extraordinary about what's happening at Standing Rock is the unity of the tribes to stand together. I mean, several hundred tribes have come together, have signed resolutions, and formally supported the Standing Rock Sioux Nation. And even tribes that actually do participate in extractive industries, like the Navajo Nation, like the Crow Nation, like the Fort Berthold, the Mandan Hidatsa Rikara Nation, which is actually where the oil is coming from, 30% of it comes from there, that's going to be in the pipeline. But they all stand with Standing Rock because they understand the issue is sovereignty. So this is very, as well as climate change, but primarily I think for many tribes the issue is sovereignty. And here there's a picture of the young people from Cannonball coming, saying Waters Life, Mini Wachoni, coming into camp. So. What I wanted to look at here was the differing relationships to land that each of these ideologies, I guess, espouse. Privatization of public lands versus sacred lands. A pro-privatization stance can be traced to the individualistic nature of the promise of the American dream. One of the things that the Bundys and many of these folks are fighting for is the right to do whatever they want on public lands. They don't want any regulations at all. They want to be able to make money, you know, put their cattle wherever they want with no concern for what it would do to the environment, just so they can keep their own, you know, their own ranches afloat. And in the case of Burns, Oregon, you know, the lumber, the timber industry. Then also the Bundy claims to pre-existing ownership of the BLM land is false. And also privatization reduces oversight and leads to destruction of sacred sites. So this is, but what Ammon Bundy was saying was that if they could privatize the refuge, the Malheur Wildlife Refuge, they could actually, the ranchers could have real access to it to utilize it. But in fact, the refuge actually was privately owned in the 19th century. It was bought up even back then they had corporate ranching. And there was a big corporate rancher from California. He bought up all the land in the area and reduced the local ranchers to be basically squatters. They were squatting on the land to try to get land. He was kicking them off. And they actually killed his overseer, the local community did. And then they held a trial and they absolved themselves of his murder. And so this notion that if we could just privatize everything, then the local ranchers could have access to it, is actually, it's not true. History doesn't show that to be true. This is an actual rancher from Harney County, and I got to interview him and other ranchers who had worked for 10 years on a compact to manage the wildlife refuge, and they'd worked with the tribe, with the Burns Paiute tribe, with conservation groups, and Fish and Wildlife Service, and they worked. They got to know each other because they worked together for 10 years. They told me they had like boxes and boxes of material that they had gone through over those years, and they'd really come to trust each other. And the compact they created to manage that refuge is the gold standard nationwide. It's considered the best, and they're very proud of what they did, and they were hoping that the media would talk about it. And so this is Gary Marshall. He's chair of the High Desert Partnership. And he says, he basically told me that those people who took over Malheur weren't ranchers, they were lost souls. And this is from Charlotte Roderick. She's the Burns Paiute Tribal. She was a Burns Paiute Tribal chairperson, and I got to know her really well while I was working on this. She says, "We don't want people who have no interest at all ramrodding themselves into the discussion. I understand Mr. Bundy is going back to Las Vegas. He can give back land to the Paiute there. For those who don't know, our tribe ranged all over Nevada, Utah, and California, and southwestern Idaho. We are all interrelated. We all speak the same language. Some variation in dialect, but we can understand each other. I think it is important that these people know they are not just affecting the Burns Paiute." So, I didn't realize this too until I was working with the Paiute people that they actually ranged all the way down to San Diego and up to Idaho, and so they had a vast area. And they also, and it's funny because the Bundys, of course, are Mormon, and they have this idea of this their own country called Deseret, which they tried to get the U.S. to sign on to, but the U.S. didn't want to give them that land. They wanted basically the entire Paiute traditional territory. And I don't know if you've ever been to Salt Lake, but if you go to Salt Lake, like all the, my uncle took me up there, but all the Army's cannons are all facing towards the city. It just was that kind of antagonistic relationship they had with the federal government even then. As you probably all know, the Bundys were, of course, armed. They were in Nevada. They were actually pointing weapons at federal agents. And then, while it's Standing Rock people, it's a peaceful, absolutely peaceful, standoff. And in a letter to, Bundy says that if the refuge occupiers hadn't been armed, they likely wouldn't have been taken seriously and garnered the widespread attention they received. This is what he said in the court, in his court documents. Authorities would have hauled us off in a paddy wagon, that's the term he used, and the protests would have been shut down quickly. And then in a letter to Attorney Loretta Lynch from Chairman Dave Archambault, he says, from the beginning of this matter, the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe has stood strongly against the Dakota Access Pipeline and strongly in favor of peaceful and prayerful means of expressing that opposition. The right of people to come together lawfully and be heard on this matter must be protected. This principle was echoed in September 9th joint statement of the Justice Army. Basically he's saying that they're peaceful. This is actually a picture of Ryan Bundy armed at the refuge. He had this lovely quote. We also recognize that the Native Americans had the claim to the land, but they lost that claim, Bundy said. There are things to learn from cultures of the past, but the current culture is the most important. And of course, he classes his own in the current culture. I don't know. I think that it's pretty... it's self-serving. So, and here they are armed, in Nevada. And here they are armed in Oregon. And this is just Chairman Archambault calling for peace and prayers. And this is just I just did a real rundown of all the different sort of activities that happened, because they sort of happened, some of them concurrently. So the militarized response, Malheur versus Standing Rock. On January 26, 2016, Lavoie Finneken is shot, and Ammon Bundy and Ryan Bundy are arrested. February 11, 2016, the last holdouts peacefully surrender after occupying wildlife refuge for 40 days. August 12, 2016, Chairman Archambault and others are arrested and strip searched. September 3, 2016, 30 protectors pepper sprayed and 6 bitten by dogs, including a child. And they said of course, what was concerning to the sheriff's department was that 2 dogs were injured. And even the AP reporter out of North Dakota, he led his article with the injuries to the dogs. On October 27, 2016, the forward camp was assaulted. 141 were arrested and temporarily housed in kennel-like closures and had identification numbers written on their arms. Red Von Fallis was accused of shooting police as they tried to arrest her and charged with attempted murder. Of course, the other guys were armed, but they were never faced that sort of attempted murder or charges. October 28, 2016, Ryan, Ammon Bundy, and 4 others acquitted of federal conspiracy and weapons charges in Oregon. So they were found completely. This is the day after the forward camp, the 1851 treaty camp, was assaulted. The next day, the Bundys and 4 of their supporters were completely acquitted of all charges in Oregon. They were found non-guilty by a jury of white people. November 3rd, 2016, activists gathered to pray are met with pepper spray and rubber bullets from police. A journalist is shot with a rubber bullet, and although captured on video, police later say the incident never happened. November 20th, 2016, before Thanksgiving, police deploy water cannons for 5 hours and tear gas on protesters in below-freezing weather. 167 protesters are injured, including Sophia Wolanski, and she was in danger of having her arm amputated after being hit by a concussion grenade, and Vanessa Dundon, a Navajo activist who lost an eye after being shot at close range by pepper spray. These are some shots of some of the violence that occurred. This is actually of the shooting of Lavoie Finneken, which is tomorrow is going to be the 1 year anniversary. And here is the dogs being used on protesters, water protectors. Here they are being just sprayed down with pepper spray. And up above there, that used to be a ranch that was owned by Standing Rock Sioux tribal members. And some people were fearful that there were family members still buried up there, which is one of the reasons they wanted to get up there. This is from the assault on the 1851 treaty camp, the forward camp. And this is the use of a water cannon in sub-freezing temperatures. In the middle of the night, I think it went all night. They went for 5 hours spraying people down. And the media coverage, you see that that these guys had no problem getting media coverage. The media camped out there, CNN and everything all the time. And I remember hearing on Oregon Public Radio them saying, at times there were more media than protesters. And then, of course, it's the exact opposite at Standing Rock. For a long time, the media ignored what was going on. Even the dog bites could not make the news. But after the Thanksgiving assault with the water cannons, finally CNN came out, and the woman, Sarita Sidner, she explained, "Well, we were very busy with the presidential election. Now it's over. Now we can come and cover you." So, let's see. This is sort of a scary quote from President Trump's inaugural address. I put it here because it is very similar to the sort of thing you hear the Bundys and other folks like their supporters saying. "Because today we are not merely transferring power from one administration to another or from one party to another, but we are transferring power from Washington, D.C. and giving it back to you, the American people. For too long, a small group in our nation's capital has reaped the rewards of government, while the people who have borne the cost. Washington flourished, but the people did not share in its wealth. Politicians prospered, but the jobs left and the factories closed. At the bedrock of our politics will be a total allegiance to the United States of America, and through our loyalty to our country, we will rediscover our loyalty to each other." So, and one of his campaign officials was very, 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 was very happy with when the Bundys got off. And of course, here he is signing the Keystone XL. This is the Standing Rock Sioux Tribes response. Basically, it's Chairman Archambault is reasserting the treaties, the issue of honoring treaties, of which I imagine Trump knows very little about. And my last question would be, where do we go from here? Sovereignty in the Trump era. And this is my great-great-aunt, Ella DeLoria. And she was born at Wakpala on Standing Rock. And she grew up to become an ethnologist. She studied at Columbia University and studied under Franz Boas. And she came back. She is fluent in all three dialects, the Lakota, Dakota, and Nakota dialects. And she began to interview elders in 1916 and continued this until she died in the 1970s. And I really recommend you read her writing. I brought one here, speaking of Indians. And her writing is really, what she's documented is really unique. You won't find what she wrote about anywhere else. She writes about what our society was like when it was intact, when it was whole. And she's interviewed hundreds of Dakota, Lakota people who lived that life, who knew it. And she wrote their stories down in the language. And then she did one translation that was word for word. And then she did a second translation that retained the cultural idioms, the context of what the stories were about. So in this book, she talks a lot about kinship, and she talks about a way of life that works. Let's see here. Let me just read from here. So she talks about a scheme of life that worked, kinship's role in Dakota life. "All peoples who live communally must first find some way to get along together, harmoniously and with a measure of decency and order. This is a universal problem. Each people have solved it in their own way. And that way, by whatever rules and controls is achieved, is for any people the scheme of life that works. The Dakota people of the past found a way. It was through kinship." And The day that Trump was elected, my daughter, she's 16 years old, and she was going to go with her friends to a protest in Portland. But she was just very sad. I mean, I think for young people of color, the vote, electing the president like this feels like a rejection of them as part of this country. And so I read her this chapter from my great-great-aunt Ella, and to give her a vision of a different life, of how we ordered our lives at one time, you know, and she had a beautiful story at the end. And let's see if I can find her. Hold on, sorry, I should have marked it. Okay, here it is. And this is a Yankton story. And it gives you a notion of how they organize themselves. So all right, so the murder of a fellow Dakota was a crime punishable either through immediate reprisal by the kinsmen of the slain or resort to the ancient ordeals. However, now and again, influenced by exceptionally wise leadership, the relatives of a murdered man might agree not to shoot the murderer or demand the ordeal for him, but instead to win his abiding loyalty through kinship. This they did by actually adopting him to be one of them in place of his victim. It was a moving scene when this was done. I wish I could describe it step by step. I have the most impressive account of such an episode, which I transcribed in the Dakota language while old Simon Antelope, a well-known, reliable Yankton man, told it. I can give only snatches of it here in a free translation. The angry younger relatives debated the kind of punishment fitting the crime while their wise elder listened, seemingly in accord with them. But after a good while, he began to speak. Skillfully, he began by going along with them. My brothers and cousins, my sons and nephews, we have been caused to weep without shame, men though we are. No wonder we are enraged, for our pride and honor have been grossly violated. Why shouldn't we go out then and give the murderer what he deserves? Then after an ominous pause, he suddenly shifted into another gear. And yet, my kinsmen, there is a better way. Slowly and clearly, he explained that better way. They were men of standing, he reminded them, and therefore it was becoming in them to act accordingly. He challenged them to reject the traditional and choose the better way. It was also the hard way, but the only certain way to put out the fire in all their hearts and in the murderers. Each of you bring to me the thing you prize the most. These things shall be a token of our intention. We shall give them to the murderer who has hurt us, and he shall thereby become something to us, an idiom for relative, in place of him who is gone. Was the dead your brother? Then this man shall be your brother, or your uncle, or your cousin. As for me, he was my nephew, so this man shall be my nephew. And from now on, he shall be one of us, and our endless concern shall be to regard him as though he were truly our loved one come back to us. And they did just that. The slayer was brought to the council not knowing what his fate was to be. Steeling himself for the worst, he kept his eyes averted. He did not try to infer the decision by peering into the councilmen's faces. He was not going to have it said of him in after years. Poor thing, how I pitied him. Like some hunted creature, he tried furtively to read mercy in men's eyes. No, he would not flinch at having to give up his life after taking another's. He too was a man. But when the council speaker offered him the peace pipe, saying, "Smoke now with these your new relatives, for they have chosen to take you to themselves in place of one who is not here," his heart began to melt. "It is their heart's wish that henceforth you shall be one of them, shall go out and come in without fear. Be confident their love and compassion which were his are now yours forever." And during that speech, tears trickled down the murderer's face. "He had been trapped by loving kinship," my informant said, "and you can be sure that he made an even better relative than many who are related by blood, because he had been bought at such a price. And what might easily have become burning rancor and hatred, perhaps leading to further violence, was purged away from the hearts of all. It was, of course, obligatory on all of the slain man's immediate relatives by blood and marriage to receive him properly, and the men, women, and even children quickly fell into line, without awkwardness, accepting the situation and behaving according as each was now related to him. These proper attitudes and behaviors accompanying each term were, as I have said before, ingrained in them from constant practice until they were automatic, until they were instinctive. I nearly said, but of course that is not the word. It is not instinctive to be unselfish, kind, and sincere towards others, and therefore courteous. Those are traits that have to be learned, and they can be learned, but only by scrupulous repetition until they become automatic responses, until in the case of the Dakotas, the very uttering of a kinship term at once brought the whole process into synchronic play. Kinship term, attitude, behavior, like a chord that is harmonious. To summarize and perhaps also to catch up some points not yet clear, I have this to say. This chapter tries to give the basic principles of the Dakota kinship system and to explain its purpose and influence in tribal life. What I have given here is, of course, the ideal picture, but I can honestly say that hardly 1 in 100 dared to be thought of as deviating from its rule. Although there were always a few naturally heedless persons. But at that one's class with the Witko, the naughty, irresponsible child, the outlaw adult, the mentally foolish, the drunk, no adult in his right mind cared to be so classed. I run a risk in leaving the subject with such an emphasis on the facility with which new relatives could be made. Anyway, she talks more about the kinship system. I think that many people think that the Dakota Lakota people were just about being warriors. She has another thing I love to say where she says that it was the kinship system that made us human, and that without it we would cease to be human. And that it meant to be a good relative meant more to our people than good times, glory, wealth, anything, life itself. And I think this is key. I think that many people came to this land looking for their pot of gold, but what maybe they really need to be looking at are these relationships. This did not work very well. Deloria. This is a quote. I wanted to include this quote because I wrote this for a piece I wrote called "Wounded by Wounded Knee," still wounded by Wounded Knee, and. Every year in December, two big things occur. One is the anniversary of Wounded Knee, of the massacre, and the second one is the Mankato, the mass hangings. And my family have stories about both. And I often have to see that image at Wounded Knee of the people frozen, and people send it to me, and it's very hard, you know. My grandmother's uncle was the Episcopal minister there. He was a Dakota man, and he turned his church into a hospital and rode out with Dr. Charles Eastman, another Dakota man, to save the people, bring them back. So it says, my grandmother says he died 2 years later of a broken heart. He was a young man. This image is filled with all those things that as Native people we cannot name. It remains a symbol of all the things, the ways in which we are not allowed to be ordinary Americans, simply living our lives in the most powerful nation in the world. December 29th, 1890 is the date when we became a marginalized people, denied the comfort of being part of a nation that recognizes our experiences and commemorates them with us. We live out our lives in this so-called democracy in a twilight existence, where the only time Americans remember us is as we were then, when we were truly separate from them. Then they dress up like us with feathered headbands made in China and cheer for their sports teams on weekends named to honor us, not acknowledging us as we are today, as our encounter with them has made us. And I include this to say that, you know, sovereignty is not only legally real and morally important that Americans honor our indigenous people's indigenous nations' sovereignty, but in real ways. But also, it's absolutely necessary for the survival of young Native people, who have some of the highest rates of suicide, and the marginalization they experience in the society is not going away, and it probably won't go away. This is probably the 13 original colonies. I wanted to say that. I guess I was going to talk about the colony thing here, where I feel like the Bundys and their ideas come out of these notions of colonialism. And you can see that the 13 original colonies weren't the states they are today. They were just there on the edge. And that border there, that's the Iroquois Confederacy, the top border there. And my husband is Iroquois. It was the cultural exchange that occurred between the colonists and these intact indigenous societies that led to the modern age. They were inspired by the Tadaho, by the Great Law of Peace to unify and create the United States and form a constitution. what the Bundys are always talking about. And also, it was observing Seneca women reorganizing their government. Seneca Falls, New York, had a Seneca village adjacent to it. And it was observing these women reorganize their government that inspired the Elizabeth Cady Stanton and many early suffragettes to pursue women's rights and made it seem like it was real, achievable, because they could see women living it right next to them. So when we talk about modernism and the ideals that we take out into the world, these came out of the exchange between these cultures, the exchange between our indigenous, intact indigenous societies and the colonies. And I thought I'd end with this. It's a quote from my grandma's cousin, Vine Deloria Jr. And this is from his book, Power and Place. The best description of Indian metaphysics was the realization that the world and all its possible experiences constituted a social reality, a fabric of life in which everything had the possibility of intimate knowing relationships, because ultimately everything was related. This world was a unified world. These two concepts were place and power. Familiarity with the personality of objects and entities of the natural world enabled Indians to determine immediately where each living being had its proper place and what kind of experiences that place allowed, encouraged, and suggested. And so when we talk about these public lands, we talk about how we make our lives on these lands. And, I think that, to me, this just exemplifies what that means to me and what the value that is in our traditional cultures, our nations, and why they need to be supported.